American Empire. In an undisclosed location in the Rocky Mountains, tearing down the invisible walls of the overdeveloped world, one interview at a time. The Soulcast with your host, Soul.
Oh shit, got my man Jared Paul, founding member of the band Prayers for Atheists, OG from Strange Famous Records. He's a rapper, activist, poet, slam poet champion. Dude has been holding it down all over the world, getting arrested, doing teach-ins, fighting the power at every opportunity. If I had to sum up integrity with indeed and action and art, Jared Paul pretty much represents that to a T. You can learn more about him at jaredpaul.org. And now, a word from our sponsors. Jared Paul, welcome to the Soulcast.
Oh, it's good to be here, man. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure, man. It's my pleasure. All right, I have a bunch of questions for you. I got some questions from supporters online. We'll just get into it. So, I guess we'll start with how most people know you. You know, all the people that I've known, all the artists, musicians, poets, whatever, you've always been the most diehard, you know, radical in what you believe, that I've known. I mean, whether it was, you know, not buying anything, or, you know, like, when you used to drink coffee, making sure it was free trade, from everything to, you know, getting arrested for conspiracy to riot in Minneapolis. And yeah, I don't know, man, you've just always put your body where your mouth is, and I respect that. So I guess we'll start with the gangster shit.
Before we go any further, I just want to put in there real quick. I mean, it's so interesting right off the bat how capitalism shifts things, you know, like free trade. Like, we hear the term free trade and think it's a good thing. You know, but we boy, you know, because free sounds good, open, you know, for everybody. But free trade is the coffee that we boycott. Equal exchange coffee or fair trade, if we can certify that it's, you know, legit fair trade, is the coffee that I am down for. Free trade is the coffee that I boycott.
Right, absolutely. But even, you know, I mean, it gets really complicated with the consumerism shit, because stuff like even fair trade gets co-opted by people at Starbucks, and then it becomes a substitute for any kind of activity, and people just try to buy their way out of...
No doubt. I'm with it for sure. But what I was saying was, when you set it up, you said free trade coffee.
And oh, did I say free trade?
Yeah.
What a fucking asshole.
No, it's put out there so much that even when I, for instance, you know, there's television shows that make fun of people like me, people like us, for wanting to buy equal exchange coffee or fair trade coffee. Comedy shows and skits, even when they're making fun of us, they get it wrong. I've seen comedy sketches making fun of fair trade coffee, but they fuck it up and call it free trade coffee because they don't know what they're talking about. But they, you know, that's how pervasive and that's how slick that terminology is. That automatically, in that Rorschach inkblot test in our mind, you know, free trade is the one that we would automatically assume. You know, like, as we, and I'm not going to get into it too much. Obviously, we've got to move forward, but. You know, like you've talked about in the past, the role that psychologists and advanced psychology has played in advertising throughout capitalism. You know, these terms that they come up with, they're not accidental. They're very calculated, and it's, you know, they work their way into our psyche, and they sound logical. Free trade, why would that be a bad thing? You know.
Yeah, Operation Iraqi Freedom. What's so bad about that?
That's it.
Well, anyway, you had some felonies slapped on you in St. Paul, and there's definitely been some developments with all of that, with that case in the last 4 months. So do you want to talk about that real quick, like what happened, and then what ended up happening with the civil suit?
Yeah, you know, I've actually been arrested at 3 out of the last 4, or had been up until 2012, 3 out of 4 major party conventions in between 2004 and 2008. And, you know, just for taking part in you know, lawful, legal activities of protest. In 2004, I was, you know, marching in a silent peace vigil from Ground Zero to City Hall against the war. In 2008 in Denver, I was helping people out of the street who were being beat up and maced by cops. And in St. Paul, I was doing nothing more than walking through a park on my way to cover the Take Back Labor Day concert that SEIU had sponsored. Service Employees International Union had sponsored. You know, obviously some, you know, SEIU is not perfect, and there's all kinds of issues that people have with their bureaucratic ways, but I do believe they were, you know, they were trying to do a good thing. They were putting on this concert knowing that there were going to be a bunch of young radicals in town. You know, and Billy Bragg was playing at it, Most Def, Atmosphere. They had Iraq Veterans Against War featured throughout the concert, you know, connecting how the, you know, the war was bad for workers, supporting unions, supporting workers, et cetera. And I was normally, you know, at these type of events, I'm mostly there to raise hell and either, you know, and by that I mean like being where the direct action is, you know, doing what I can to learn about the process and support the direct action on the ground. But this particular time, I had been arrested at you know, just the week before in Denver, and I had been, you know, arrested at, you know, at the previous one in New York 4 years earlier, and I, you know, was understood how easy it was to get locked up. So I was heading over to cover this concert, which was less radical than some of the events that I would normally be taking part in or covering. And I was there, I you know, in partial capacity, working on a story for a small monthly publication in Rhode Island called The Agenda, a small monthly paper here. You know, it wasn't a paid gig. It was, you know, they knew my work and knew that I was going to be out there and asked me if I would, you know, handle an assignment. So I thought this concert would be a great thing that I could cover without risking arrest. That was actually worth my time to cover. But, you know, as I was on my way over there, you know, we had gone to a large march during the morning, which was aggressive but lawful. 20,000 people came, all these different organizations from around the country. It was great. And we had to sort of weave our way through these neighborhoods to get across the Mississippi to find the concert, because we couldn't take the most direct route to get there. They, you know, due to the fact that they had these, the city looked like a police state. Hundreds and hundreds of riot police from all over the country. You know, any, you can pick the acronym, whatever acronym you want, NSA, CIA, FBI, you know, alcohol, tobacco, and firearm, ATF, you know, I mean, they were all there. Snipers on the roof, people with cameras and telescopes on the roofs, and that's not abnormal. You know, they have that at all the conventions now, but this was, you know, for a small city like St. Paul, it was even it seemed even more intensified. But you couldn't walk down many of the major roads after the protest because they had these huge checkpoints set up, and you could walk through it, but you had to, you know. If you looked like an activist, they were stopping you, asking for your ID, potentially pulling you aside for questions, all this other stuff. And so my, you know, my friends and I found it offensive, and we didn't want any part of it. And so we took, you know, smaller roads to try to, you know, follow this bootleg city map to get through the neighborhoods down to the Mississippi and over the bridge to where the concert was. It took us a long time. Eventually we could, you know, after like 20, 30 minutes of walking, we could actually hear the concert. We came out into the Shepherd Road River Park, There's all kinds of people there, college students, joggers, people walking their dog, people picnicking, people on their way to the concert, people had come back from the concert, you know. And so we realized, although we're not at the actual show, we can see the Harriet Island Pavilion across the Mississippi. But it's such a beautiful day, and we've been walking for so long that, you know, we stopped to listen, you know, just to relax and listen. Tom Morello was on stage doing the Night Watchman set. It's really, really cool. Then we listened to Iraq Veterans Against War speak, you know, and then Atmosphere came on. And, you know, we were all Atmosphere fans, and, you know, we decided that, you know, we're done waiting. And so we headed north along the river to the bridge, which led over to where Harriet Island Pavilion was. But at that time, you know, the police began cracking down around the city, arresting pockets of protesters and citizens, passersby, even business people who were in the wrong place at the wrong time, and, you know, arrested a couple hundred people. And they were, kettling a group of protesters who had been part of a decentralized march, and they pushed them back into the park as we were walking out of it. And then they surrounded it, in a blink, you know. More riot police than I could count, you know, coming down the street, kettling this small group of protesters into the park, and then bicycle police, motorcycle cops, SWAT team van, Coast Guard boats in the river behind us. They literally formed a perimeter with over 100 officers and agents, you know, government officials, government agents from different, you know, various groups. They arrested, you know, they wouldn't answer any questions. They wouldn't even acknowledge your existence. They scared the shit out of everybody and locked us in there for, you know, I don't know, a long time. And they came through making a sweep for the key troublemakers, or what they deemed as key troublemakers, you know, on some Gestapo shit. And then eventually just loaded everybody up onto these city buses after photographing us. Loaded us up onto these city buses and drove us to Ramsey County Jail.
So, did everybody get conspiracy to riot, or was it just you and a couple people?
In the beginning, they charged almost everybody there with felony riot.
Crazy.
You know, and that's... It's conjecture, but, I mean, it's what I believe and what many other believes, what many other people believe, is that... in some senses, at protests and these direct actions, all revolutionary rehearsals for us, they're very realistically revolutionary rehearsals for the ruling class as well. Anybody that you know, the police administrators and the police and these other government agencies are, you know, hate protests and so put out and bothered by these protests is completely has it twisted. You know, the way that it looked.
Hey, Jared. Jared.
Yeah.
Do you have anything running in the background on your computer?
No.
Okay, are you moving around?
No.
Okay, because, like, you keep dropping in and out.
Maybe.
So, I don't know. All right, keep going.
They use these events, you know, the police and the administrators in the police station and the FBI, you know, they're not angry about protests. They're not pissed off that these things are happening. These are opportunities for them to literally try out new tactics, literally experiment with new equipment, flash bang grenades, sound weapons, practice and drill for their paramilitary units, and I don't mean that in like the black helicopter way. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. You know, I mean it in a very scientific, dialectical fashion. Every major city in the country now has a paramilitary unit within its police station. And these protests are training grounds where the police are experiment with how to employ kettling tactics, with how to deal with advanced crowd control, with how to use their gear, their, you know, fancy $1,000 stormtrooper gear, hydration packs, gas masks, tactical drills. And you watch them when they surround Kettle in advance protesters in these larger protests, DNC, RNC, Free Trade Act of the Americas protests, IMF, Bank, you know, whenever there's a large radical protest to these events, you can watch the paramilitary tactical displays by, you know, by the riot police, and they look just like you see Marines do in the movies. You know, they're practicing, you know, they move in regimented fashion. They get orders when to move, when to halt, when to fan out, just like they do in the military. And that's what it is. It's a paramilitary unit. And it's doubly or compounded on top of that is the fact that the same way that Halliburton and Raytheon and Bechtel and other weapons manufacturers and equipment manufacturers that are needed for war and invasion and occupation and spying and all that end up being, you know, this sort of corporate welfare. There's fortunes being made now in the sale of this gear, you know, advanced paramilitary riot gear, helmets, visors, gas masks, chest plates, body armor, hydration packs, you know, utility belts, sound weapons, beanbag guns, rubber bullets. It's a whole other aspect to the market that's opening up for these, you know, for these weapons manufacturers and these other companies. And they're, you know, they want it, you know, they're going to have, just like any other capitalist corporation or capitalist market, they want to sell as much of that stuff as possible. And to that end, there, you know, there's not going to be less military police. And I'll close this answer by saying, I mean, even if you separate it from a protest standpoint and apply it, say, like a Red Sox game. In 2006, after the Boston Red Sox won the American American Championship Series, you know, people poured into the streets in Boston, and they were wild. You know, they're celebrating, kissing, high fiving, smashing bottles. You know, just like people do, and they had riot police at the game. Riot police lined up along the baseline to prevent people who wanted to run on the field and celebrate. I'm not talking about bouncers.
Crazy.
I'm not talking about bouncers.
What the fuck?
We're not talking about security. You know, we're talking about riot police with body armor and weapons. And when that protest, you know, or not protest, when that celebration went into the streets and it got rowdy, you know, they started arresting people, beating people up, shooting people. And in one instance, a young police officer fired a rubber bullet gun into a crowd and hit an 18-year-old college student at Emerson College named Victoria Snellgrove in the eye. And, you know, she died right there. You know, and that's a, you know, they weren't worried about the fans tearing down Fenway Park. They weren't really worried that the fans were going to do any amount of crazy damage downtown Boston. You know, it was mostly, in my opinion, and you know, much more to the fact point, you know, an opportunity to in this security, you know, the modern security state, you know, to flex this display of power, to experiment with advancing the opportunities where it's acceptable for these type of paramilitary troops to be used, you know, and an opportunity for, you know, them to, you know, they have to justify these budgets, why they spend this much money on this equipment, why they spend this much money on training officers in this tactical, you know, and in these tactical, maneuvers and strategies. And so, you know, you're not going to see less of that. We're going to see more of that as things advance. And really, you know, you can talk to some police on the down low. You know, they don't get, most of the time, the riots don't get jumped into this. It's not like the boss saying, you know, Hernandez, Chinaski, you know, you're on riot police duty. It's they sign up for it. Police volunteer to be part of the paramilitary unit within because they know that it's going to be an opportunity for them to make some serious, you know, a whole night or something like FTAA or World Bank or DNC RNC, a full day, two full days. Two or three 14-hour days making time and a half, in addition to what they already made that week. You know, it's working class people don't see that money. And although I don't consider police to be a standard part of the working class, they're working class people, but they're separate because they're employed, whether they know it or not, to defend capital and defend the state. They're, in terms of, you know, the money that they make, they're completely and totally working class people. Often start off at, you know, $24,000 a year or something. And, you know, people aren't going to, you get an opportunity to make enough money to pay your rent for 2 months or your mortgage for 2 or 3 months by going to, you know, play Starship Trooper for some punk ass kids. You know, They're excited to get the overtime.
Yeah, it's fucked up, man. I mean, the only thing I'll add to what you said is, or that was left out, is that, like, I noticed in a city like Denver, you know, after they have the DNC here, and there's a reason why they spread it out from city to city to city to city, because when they have them in these cities, not only do these weapons manufacturers and all these, like, surveillance people get these huge handouts, but the city then gets to have this incredible infrastructure afterwards. So it's like Denver is so heavily surveilled. There's halo cameras all over the city. And they just, I mean, sometimes when we're doing marches, they don't even send cops. You can just tell they have somebody watching us on halo cameras, just waiting for us to, you know, smash a window or whatever. But anyway, all right, So with prayers for, okay, you come from, you kind of rose to prominence through the slam poetry scene, but I would say a lot of it through, like, the Strange Famous Records, Providence hip hop scene, which is also tied in with the slam poetry scene to a certain extent. But most of that scene is playing clubs and venues. And when you started Prayers for Atheists, which is a kind of punkish rap group, you made a conscious decision to play DIY spaces, and doing these, you know, intense 3-month tours playing these DIY spaces. And I've been playing a lot of those spaces recently also, and what really, like, strikes me is the kind of people who, you know, they're the kind of people who are actually doing shit. You know, they're not there to drink, they're there for music, they're there for the ideas. So I guess my question is, how important is it for you to play those kind of spaces, and how do you feel like it informs your art and activism?
You know, we wanted to play. We were hungry. We were hunting. You know, I watched my friends play music for years, your stuff, Soliloquist of Sound, Grand Buffet, and the music scene here in Providence is intense. You know, to make music, but I was busy, you know, coaching the youth slam team for Providence Slam, protesting, counseling in group homes, you know, and working out, you know, a lot of performance poetry or the performance poetry end of my craft, you know, and I really had to, it took me a long time to figure out really how to make songs or develop my own style in making songs and how to play. Just rapping by myself with a DJ or with a CD player didn't feel right. For me personally, I wanted to play with a band, you know, and that really getting to practicing with the band and finding folks to play was my education and how to perform music live. I knew control the crowd already because I'd been on, you know, traveled the country doing performance poetry tournaments, and Sage. Obviously big up to Strange Famous Records and to Sage and Bernard and everybody over there. In 2004 and in 2005, you know, I went on both of the National Sage Francis tours. So in addition to, you know, I was a featured poet on both of those tours. So, you know, in addition to all the Poetry Slam stuff and the competing stuff, I had already, you know, performed at, you know, 80 shows with 500 or more people at them. And I came home and I wanted to figure out how to play live music and balance all the other things. And so by practicing and putting the band together, that's really how I figured out my own style of songwriting and how to perform them, to performing poetry live. And once we got that, we didn't start out until we were like, had stuff that we were really excited about. You know, and that we really felt could hang with, we would put on the side of anybody's music, you know, and and was excited about it, and we made the decision to put out an 8-song EP instead of something that was longer with like 10 or 12 tracks or whatever. But you know, we were itching. The young guys in the band, they were toured before. You know, we burned down the local shows that we played. We just went off, and they went as well or better than we hoped. And so, I leveraged all the friends and comrades that I had made through the years of traveling with the Providence Slam team, through traveling with Francis, through doing solo tours and short runs, and. No agent wanted to, you know, there weren't agents who wanted to work with us. There weren't promoters who were excited to work with us. But because, you know, I was established in that other genre, and because I was known through Strange Famous and a part of the Strange Famous family, you know, I reach out. There was almost no city that we wanted to play where I didn't have a friend or a connection, either through protesting there, being part of counterculture there, down with socialists and anarchists there, knowing somebody from the poetry community there, or multiple communities there, or somebody from the underground independent hip-hop. And so even though we weren't this big established act, was able to reach out to every city that we wanted to play around the country and find radical folks who wanted to, who wanted with us and were down, you know, for music with a cause and for counterculture events. And it also helped me, I mean, we played legitimate venues too, you know, Knitting Factory in Los Angeles and, trying to think, you know, Fire Escape in Sacramento. We played some legitimate stuff too, and I think clubs that wouldn't normally book unknown acts booked us because of my resume. And so we really played whatever we could get our hands on, as long as it was all ages, and as long as the folks were excited about it. And what happened was, you know, because we were so not only open to that but pushing for that, we were like, if there's a socialist group, an anarchist info shop, you know, there's a police brutality movement, like any Prayers for Atheists show that happens should also be equal parts counterculture. You know, we would have to cap at a certain point, but you know, if you got five groups who are all doing badass move in your city, we want them to speak on stage if they want to. We'll give them 3 minutes. We'll give them 5 minutes to talk about their cause, to explain to people why shit is real and they need to get involved. We offered all those groups, tabling space, the opportunity to pass around their email lists and petitions, etc. So 200 shows, which it's hard for me to even really fathom that, but we did 200 shows in 2.5 years without a single any help from any agent or any proper promoter, really. Just mutual aid, taking part in the curation of the shows, collaborative curation, to make sure that there were three to four like-minded bands on the bill, and a whole, you know, whatever community action groups the folks on the ground knew or thought were really kicking ass in their city. And so, you know, small DIY venues, sometimes they were legit venues, and we turned like like bar into a fucking counterculture show where they had never even had a show like that before, where all of a sudden there's two groups, spoken word set, and two radical punk bands, and five information tables in the back, socialists, anarchists, you know, women's rights, environmental rights, etc., and turn some bar, some tiny bar that wasn't radical at all, into a radical zone. Some nights it would be a the Boeing Collective in Salt Lake City, anarchists that I got around in St. Paul, playing a radical house show in Portland, Oregon, like the Blood Bank, or playing an independent, collectively run venue in SLC like Kilby Court, which is a great music venue, but is not owned by any, you know, corporate dumb shit. The workers there have a say in how it goes. We were anywhere, any night. Basement show, attic show, bar show, show in a hallway, show in some great club. It was a mixed bag, and it was written by a guy.
Yeah, it was inspiring. You guys toured hard, man. You guys, I remember there were some winters where you guys would just be driving through the middle of fucking nowhere, and you'd be calling me on the phone like, "I'm dying." Like, oh man, it's hard out there, man. It's really hard out there. And so right now, Prayers for Atheists is kind of on hiatus for a while, and you're focusing more on your solo hip hop and spoken word stuff. I got a question from someone online, from Decomposure, and he wants to know, how do you survive? I'm sure it's a broader question for artists in general, but his question is basically like, you know, how do you survive? How do you make money? Do you have a job? Where do you draw your revenue from? How do you eat?
I think my life through my art since 2006. I do down work that I can do when I'm not on tour. Like, if a friend of mine, I live at I have an artist residency at ASU20 Collective. It's ASU20.org. It's one of the few radical arts collectives that I know of that's actually winning. I mean, some people wouldn't even call it radical anymore because it's, we own three, and you know, it's you know,
it's nice. It's really nice also.
Nice. But you know, in when the third building was finished, for a whole week, because it's this huge space with, you know, 40 or 30 live studios and 20 independent art studios and a print shop and all this shit. You know, while the fire system was being installed, there was no way to tell if it was going off in the middle of the night because it was being worked on. And even though the chances were unlikely that the sprinkler system would malfunction and go off, they couldn't take the risk of that happening. So they had to have people there all night long, you know, and they needed people to work and take those hours. So, you know, they asked me to do it. And so for 15, you know, 15 hours, I stayed up all night writing, and every 5 minutes walked through the premises to make sure nothing was leaking. I don't turn down little work that comes up like that if I'm not on tour. But 95% of my life has been paid for by my art since, for 2005 and largely since 2006 after that. And, you know, in some regards, I do, it's just my life now, but I have to take a step back sometimes and really be thankful and appreciative and really consider it, because I know that's a lot of people's dream. You know, my dream is not to live off my art. My dream is to live in a new world where suffering and brutality and capitalism and torture and corporate globalism aren't, you know, destroying everything around me, and I can get some sleep at night for the first time ever. you know, to be a touring independent artist, I'm not tall, I'm not good looking, they don't want me on the cover of a magazine, I can't sing well, my rap skills are not amazing, you know, my writing, I believe, is top notch, and I've worked very hard for that, but I go through that to say that I'm not very marketable in the mainstream sense, so I've had to do that work myself, be my own agent, be my own manager, be my own advocate, and in addition to that, my own accountant and my own economic planner,
and your own guru, your own chef,
but the reality is that it's, you know, it's about living within your means. I live in an artist residency, you know, and I found that and applied for it. And so I have an extremely affordable rent with my heating and Wi-Fi included in that. When I go away on tour, I work hard in the lead up to it to make sure that I have a responsible person who I love and know and trust to sublet my place while I'm gone. So me being gone means that I don't ever tour. I don't ever take off. Unless I have that person to cover my place. Somebody who I know, love, trust, and respect to sublet my spot. And boom, it's like I just made $500 just by going out. You know, I play a game with myself, me versus capitalism, every day and every week of my life. I try to spend as little money as possible in general. You know, I try to separate things into wants and needs. You know, and you spend money on wants sometimes, but I don't ever spend shit without knowing what's in my bank account and without assessing, you know, where I'm going to be once I spend it. You know, when I go out on tour, I have my merch bag, which has all my shirts and CDs and books in it. I have my backpack, you know, my laptop bag, which goes on my back. My office bag has my, you know, all my gear, the things I need for business. And I have my food bag. You never see me on tour without my food bag. And, you know, in addition to being vegan with a wheat allergy, you know, it's crazy to make pretend that I, you know, like corporate advertising would have us believe that we have the money to go out to eat every day, twice a day, three times, five times a week. I don't have $50, $60, $100 a week to lose on going out to eat. It's crazy. And so in my food bag, I have nutritious things that keep well. I have a water bottle. I have tons of almonds and walnuts and fruit. And, you know, sometimes I stay in motels and hotels, but not a lot of companies that I'm really down for in that regard. And I'd rather stay with, you know, friends who I've made around the country anyway. And if I, you know, do that work as my, you know, when I'm wearing the tour manager hat, and I'm wearing the tour booker hat, and I'm organizing these tours, I reach out to my friends and contemporaries and collaborators far in advance, and I don't even couch surf. I find, you know, there's people, friends, contemporaries, and collaborators who have guest bedrooms, who have basement studios, who have all these things set up, you know, and wherever I can on tour, I cut out you know, and now because I'm established and I have a career and I'm, you know, one of the more respected names in modern performance poetry, you know, these college shows and these university shows and some of these conferences and festivals, you know, pay me a good chunk of money. And when I get that money, I don't go out and blow it on, you know, some crazy shit. I don't need clothes or some trip or ball. I put it right into my financial plan for the rest of the year. And I, you know, I allocate it to what do I need to get a new badass music video designed. I'm trying to, you know, some recording equipment in my room, but I'm vigilant about my money and how I spend it, in all facets of the game. I don't have any kids. Car, you know, I've been without a car since 2001, and I don't hate on people who have cars. You know what I'm saying? You got a family, you have a particular job. In some instances, folks need a car. I blame the oil companies and the car companies for not, you know, for subverting public transportation, you know, and preventing the development that this country so badly needs in terms of rail systems and preventing, you know, the development of alternative fuel for cars in general. But I don't blame people for driving cars. I gave up my car way back in 2001 because an argument that I had in the Strange Famous Forum where somebody proved to me that having a car wasn't vegan. They were, gave me a list of those animal products that were in certain tires and breakthrough and all this other shit. And pointed out summarily all the animals that died as a result of the pipelines that they set up and the way that they set them up and the oil spills, etc. And, you know, although it would be nice to have a car sometimes, for the most part, in a city like Providence, as a young, healthy dude, I can get it, you know, between my bike and the bus system, I can get anywhere I need to go. I have an artist residency downtown Providence. I can walk to the main bus station, the main train station. I can be at any one of the beaches in the state in an hour for $2. You know?
And you're going to live longer riding your bike, that's for sure. You know?
I don't know if you're making fun of me or not.
No, I'm being serious. I mean, like, that's how I feel. Like, I love riding my bike. It's like I don't have time in the day to exercise. I don't have time to fucking pump iron and do all this CrossFit shit that motherfuckers are doing nowadays. Like, but I have time to ride my bike to the liquor store. I have time to ride my bike to meet my friends, you know? And it's healthy.
Yeah.
Well, it's... All right, well, here's another question also from the internet. I don't know about you, but I don't have any vegan friends. None of the people I know that are involved in the anti-capitalist struggle or involved in environmental, any of the stuff that we're involved in, none of my friends are vegetarians, and it blows my fucking mind. And, you know, outside of, like, you know, animal rights circles, people don't really talk about that shit. And it and it just started like clicking in my head a couple months ago when I started just really thinking about it, like, you know, how trivialized animal rights are. So this question from the internet is, how do you think veganism ties into the broader social movements going on today?
First, I want to say is that, you know, the modern anti-factory farm movement, modern vegan movement, it's not about, you know, hipsterism. It's not about elitism or fashion or any shit like that. First and foremost, the large majority of people I've come in contact with who are vegan because they want to buy or take part in the torture of living things straight off the bat. And then after that, you know, it's about the environmental sustainability of the planet, and then ultimately about the health of our bodies. I think that the animal rights movement is crucial because I, you know, if I were being tortured the way that billions of animals are, you know, if my pet was being tortured the way that, you know, if my dog was kidnapped onto a factory farm, you know, and they were snapping off his teeth because they had him in a pen with 50 other dogs and he couldn't move, and they were jacking him with hormones and steroids and on the way to fatten him up to butcher him, you know, anything in my power to save my dog. And cats, pigs, and chickens are just like my dog. They feel the same way. I would, you know, I would do anything to save my dog, and I don't understand, you know, there's a disconnect with why it's okay to do this to billion, literally billions of other animals, but it's not, you know, we would never dream of doing that to our pets. On top of that, if I kidnapped myself and sold into human trafficking, I would wonder why nobody was, you know, why is nobody coming for me? I can't rest in peace knowing that so many things are suffering unnecessarily. What good, what's the value of a society that can build, carve marble columns to the sky, or send a satellite into space, or put the information of a million libraries in an accessible Wi-Fi feed if it is absent of mercy and absent of empathy? And I think when people make that connection, which I think is starting to happen more and more, you know, that the place our food is coming from is not Walton Mountain with the happy farmer. You know, it's these sick, awful, fucked up places where the animals are being tortured, the workers are being exploited, the planet, you know, and the planet is being destroyed as a result.
Half the food is going to waste.
Yeah.
Half of the meat is going bad in transit.
You know, and I, you know, I, for me, and I think it's a connection that people are making it, even if it's phrased differently, you know, after, for me, a factory farm is the most representative. It's the most evolved example of the brutality of capitalism. There's no higher evolved area of the market that represents true capitalism than a factory farm. Literally everything is commodified. You need baby chickens, you know, you need a hatch chicken so that you can have as much poultry and as much eggs as you can. Okay, the chickens, the chicks are hatched. They're thrown on a conveyor belt. If it's a girl, you know, boom, it goes off to poultry or it goes off to egg laying. If it's a male chicken and, they, you know, if it's a male chick, they don't need it. They have a separate number for roosters. It gets thrown right into the metal grinder or thrown alive into a trash bag and thrown out. It has no purpose as a piece of equipment on the assembly line. It's not a life, it's a piece of trash. If you have 20 chickens in a cage the size of a shopping cart and they're pecking each other to death, the answer is not to get a bigger cage, because that would cost your company more money and reduce your bottom line and your payout to your shareholders. The answer is to get a cheap metal shop vise and snap the chicken's beak off. There you go. You're pecking and attacking inside of a cage. Well, why don't you put in, anesthetic or treatment on that? No, that would cost more money. And, the chicken is going to be slaughtered before it would die of infection. And generally the infection is bad, but it's not enough to taint the meat. So boom, beakless chicken, with an infected face. That, that's the answer. That's how that's what capitalism does. That's the point of it. It's to squeeze. It's not about like healthy competition and the best product wins. It's about squeezing the absolute maximum juice, the maximum milk, the maximum profit that you can out of every situation, regardless of what it does to the workers involved, the land involved, the environment. And that's why, in some senses, like, I hate Monsanto. I hate how at the end of the day, Monsanto is just doing what a corporation is supposed to do under capitalism, under this system. That's what, ultimately at the end of the day, that's what the system is about. Dominating the market, squeezing as much profit as you can out of every instance, crushing your competition and saturating the market with your product, whether it's healthy or not, whether it's useful or not. They're playing by the rules. And that's why, I don't think capitalism can be reformed. And all these years, I went to my first protest in 1998, and I got radicalized, after 9/11. But I was a reformist for a long time. I didn't know the term for it. Social democrat. I was a reformist. I didn't like capitalism, but I didn't believe it could be overthrown. I believed that you had to just, make do with the best you could inside of it. In some degrees, I was an anti-capitalist who didn't really think capitalism could be smashed. But after years of watching and researching and seeing and coming to understand that poverty and war are built-in features of capitalism, after seeing, learning, studying the labor history of this country, how many socialists and anarchists and unionists had to die, organize, and be attacked, jailed, in order for us to have the 8-hour workday, for us to have child labor laws, for us to have environmental laws, for us to have the Food and Drug Administration came out of the movement, the national outrage that sparked after Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, which people always talk about as like this vegan Bible, but really a vegan Bible, or even an animal rights Bible. It's it's a work of fiction that uses the meatpacking industry in Chicago at the turn of the century to show the real history of the time and the brutality of the system and the need for for workers to get involved and change it on their own. But all these things, I came to understand, this was because of the genius or the legacy of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, or because the great governors and senators and congressmen of the time wanted the people to have a better life. It was because working class people like myself, who we're in a direct lineage of, we are now a part of that radical history, radical legacy. Suffered, organized, worked, were killed, were executed, were jailed, so that working class people could have these rights. Education was advanced, and I think in the same way, that people are starting to see that you can't solve, you can't ignore racism. You can't ignore sexism. It's wrong on its face, but it's also will never be effective to say, well, racism is bad, but I don't care about it because I'm not black and it doesn't affect me. And really what's most important is that we fix Wall Street. That we, you know,
get our middle class lives back that we promised.
Exactly, you know, all these issues are equally important. They're all equally important to stopping the injustice that people are dealing with and the suffering that they're dealing with unnecessarily in their daily lives, and ultimately to, you know. For their justice and the equality of all these causes, but ultimately as well to raise working class consciousness and smash the system.
And, you know, and on top of it, it's like I actually know some Maoists in Denver, which is fucking shocking that there's still people walking around identifying as Maoists. But yes, there is a Maoist organization in Denver. And one of their things that they're always pushing to kind of challenge everyone's middle class sensibilities is this concept of the global 99%. And so it's like everything we're talking about kind of fits in the realm of the United States, but we don't really it's like to think about the whole world, you know, the workers in China, the workers in India, the people being dispossessed by dams. And I mean, it's fucking crazy. I mean, capitalism is destroying the planet.
Yeah. And, you know, we're not hyperbolic. There are oil spills all the time. They've had dozens of oil spills in the Amazon, in the rainforest. You know, and I agree with your assessment. You know, I literally think that capitalism, corporate globalism, is destroying the world.
You know what else? Just like a side note, is when you're talking about veganism and destroying the planet, there's a lot of critique about vegans eating soy because, you know, you have to cut down the Brazilian rainforests to grow soy. I actually know a woman in Colorado who cultivates heirloom edamame beans, and I just planted them. I planted a whole bunch of them this year just to see. And today I went out in my garden, I was weeding, and I was fucking shocked. I have all these soybeans growing in my garden. So I'm just gonna throw that out there, you know. The myth that that to be vegan we have to destroy rainforests is bullshit. We can grow soy in our yards if we so choose.
I've had a strict vegan diet for 16 years. In January, it'll make 17 years. And where my mindset is at right now is pretty controversial. You know, because although vegan diet is what I believe in and it's what's right for me right now, I've come to really learn and respect, certain locavore diets. You know, I used to believe that traditional vegan logic is that even though hunter-gatherer societies and, you know, small farming, some folks can do it in a way where the animals live with dignity until they die and they don't suffer, that it's wrong to support those businesses because everybody did that and they would just ultimately have more business than they could handle, and they would resort to the tactics that the larger farms do or that the shittier smaller farms do, and you'd be right back in the same loop. But I don't personally believe that anymore. You know, I know I have a friend of mine who's a Native American in Northern California. Not that you have to be Native American to hunt, but hunter, he's Native American, and I was staying with some friends who put on a show, and he fucked him because I was vegan. He was a supporter of my music and my poetry, and he was self-conscious
that I was going to judge him for his life, for the way that he lives. And this dude, he manages a plot of land that some other people own. He makes sure that poachers stay off the land. He makes sure that, he keeps track on the land, and he shoots. You know, he's an expert. He shoots two deer, one for their family and one for his. And I don't want to kill a deer, but I think a deer living natural in the woods of Northern California, and then 4 years into its life, you know, or 5 years, 6 years, whatever, taking a bullet in the head and dying quick is a natural life with dignity. And it died the same way it would if a mountain lion killed it, or a bear killed it, or a pack of coyotes hunted it down and killed it.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly are an apex predator, you know?
You know, I don't see anything wrong with that at all. I've met chickens now. A lot of my friends, you know, were vegan, keep chickens. A good friend of mine is a full-time farmer now. She was vegan for a long time, and now she's locavore. I met her. My friends in Eugene, Marietta, and them, you know, I met their chickens. They're happy. I know the animals aren't stressed. They have a ton of room to run. They lay eggs, and you know, they eat the eggs.
Yeah, I'm with you on the, like, I don't have to eat meat. I'm fine with it. But if you're, it all boils down to alienation, I think. It's like people who think meat comes from comes wrapped in plastic, as opposed to, you know, those who, if you're going to eat meat, go kill the fucking thing. Look it in the eyes and slit its fucking throat. If you're going to, you know, if you're going to do that, then you should know what that actually means to take a life. You know, because you can kill a deer, and that can, I mean, that'll feed a family for a year if you freeze it up. So, you know, I'd like to think that at some point we could evolve to the point where we don't want to eat meat, and no one needs to eat meat anymore. But, you know, while we have people eating meat, they should go out and kill the shit. It's like, again, you know, you go back to the Native American thing. You know, they would do dances and rituals to honor the sacrifice. You know, they were grateful for, you know, understanding that they're just part of the cycle of life, as opposed to the cycle of consumerism and just buying food, you know?
With it, you know? In a place where, like where I live in Rhode Island, you know, there is so much seafood here, even with the oceans being destroyed. And it makes sense to me. I have friends of mine. I do have a bunch of vegan friends here and a bunch of vegetarian friends here in my crew and just in extending community circles. Folks here who, you know, between farmers market and their own plots, get almost all their vegetables here for certain parts of the year. They get their eggs here where they know the chickens and have met the chickens. And they get seafood from here from you know, folks where they know the actual people, small family operation with one boat. And to me, not only is that stuff not wrong, you know, and it pisses mad. I have mad vegan friends that are pissed at me, but it's not my job to be concerned with whether or not my friends are upset with my choices. It's my, you know, I'm a dialectical materialist. You know, it's about science. It shouldn't matter. You know, the superficial aspect of things, it should matter, you know, the scientific evidence on the ground. And I've, you know, met these animals and met these small fishermen, and they're living a good life. And the way they're living, you know, the animals don't suffer, or certainly suffer much less than they would. It's a sustainable model. You know, the Native Americans that were here, the small farmers that were here, they had all the food they could eat. But the, you know, convert the co- caution my friends who think they're, you know, saving the day by buying local animal products when they don't, you know, when Whole Foods and Trader Joe's and co-ops often buy from small farms that are terrible to their animals. Often buy from small farms where they don't know how the animals are treated. Just a farm doesn't mean it's a good small farm. You know, and just, you know, you have a responsibility. If you're going to eat, in my opinion, and the way that I look at it, if you're going to eat animal products, as you said, you should either kill it yourself or know you're killing it, have watched it been killed, or eat the chickens, see how it goes down and understand. You know, and even too, and another aspect of that is a lot of small farmers used to kill their own animals. You know, or they would have a specialist who would, you know, a butcher who would come around to the farms and kill the animal quickly. But now, under capitalism, the way that this shit goes, a lot of people send their animals off to a slaughterhouse. You know, doesn't give a fuck at all. You know, and it's not a black and white issue. I don't care what any vegan says. And I believe we can grow our own edamame, but soy is a fucking destructive cash crop. You know, the way soy is farmed is destroying all kinds of topsoil. And, you know, they're obviously clear-cutting way more forest for these mass cattle ranches than they are for soy. But soy is one of the growing cash crops that forests are cleared for.
But most of that soy actually is fed to cows also. It's not the, like, you know, vegans aren't eating the fucking, you know, the Halliburton soy or whatever the shit, the Monsanto.
Like soy is coming from, where the silk soy is coming from. I know in the beginning that silk made a commitment to only buy, silk is owned by Dean Foods, which is a huge dairy company. I don't buy silk, I boycott it. You know, they made a commitment to buy American soy. And then very shortly after, they, you know, reneged on that and started, you know, buying most of the soy from China. And it's not that I have anything against Chinese workers or China as a country. It's the commitment to local farmers, and then began the process of buying a product from 5,000 miles away, which, you know, obviously a crazy strain on the environment and is not a sustainable practice.
All right. Well, let's switch it up a little. A lot of my favorite writers and thinkers come from a Marxist tradition. You know, from Situationists to Marx to people like David Harvey or, you know, whoever. And one thing that always surprises me is, you know, when I talk to my anarchist friends about, you know, and I use Marxist language or something, a lot of them get very kind of knee jerky. I kind of make this joke about the Kronstadt Rebellion in Hungary, where, you know, the anarchist uprising that Stalin put down. And just had everyone butchered, and so I always like make this joke that anarchists should wear kind of like remember 9/11, but remember Kronstadt shirts. But anyway, so it always kind of, I don't know, it always like, I don't get it, because, you know, when you read people like Kropotkin or Emma Goldman or a lot of all those anarchists, they're all drawing from the same tradition. They just have different ideas on how to get there, but we all want free communism. So you come from a more punk, anti-capitalist, anarchistish background, but in the last few years, you've begun identifying as a socialist. So I just kind of wanted you to speak on that and why, like, strategically, theoretically, or whatever, from an analytical standpoint, why your philosophy has evolved to where it's at this point.
Word. And I was hip-hop before I was punk. Found punk much later. You know, but and I go through that mostly, not to clarify, but I mean, you know, Chuck D, Public Enemy, was not the first hip-hop I heard, but it's hip-hop that hooked me. That's a good example of, you know, radical politics, but not ultra-leftist. And so, you know, comrades, I mean, I've been arrested with anarchists. I stood on picket lines with anarchists. I've formed human blockades, a block from coming into a certain area. The anarchist comrades are some of the folks who've gone to war the most for me, set shows and info shops and backyards and DIY spots, you know. I agree with you in a sense that, you know, at the end of the day, most folks want the same thing and just disagree, you know, with how to get there. You know, so I want to say, first and foremost, I'm definitely not one of these socialists who tries to convert anarchists to socialism. You know, I don't want to focus on the differences. I want to focus on the projects that we're working on together, that, you know, the areas where we can build and where we can support one another. I mean, when the liberals started attacking the anarchists at Occupy Providence, you know, because the anarchists were principled and stood up to liberal folks and juggalos who wanted to be buddy-buddy with the cops. Liberal scared juggalos because they didn't want the cops looking in their tents to find drugs, and they turned Reds. In the beginning, they tried to turn Occupy Providence into some black scare, you know, like the anarchists are going to get us all arrested. They're here to, you know, damage property and get us all arrested. You know, and it was the socialists who immediately were like, you know, this is bullshit. You know, this is, you know, the most asinine, ridiculous shit that we've heard. You know, the cops are not our friends. They're not here to make this successful. They're here to surveil you and do anything they can to act on any orders they get, to subvert this in any way that they can. You know, became a socialist because, you know, after becoming disenchanted with capitalism, after reading about the labor history of this country, civil rights history of this country, women's rights history of this country, and really understanding how complicit the Democrats were and the liberals were at every step along the way. You know, I, you know, and some people think it's great, some people think it's good, you know, but that's the way most socialists see it, is that not only is the Democratic Party not the labor party or the workers' party that it claims to be, it's one of the biggest factors preventing a party like that from developing, an organization like a mass organization like that from developing. Usurps all that radical energy and funnels it into all this defeatist, apologist, neoliberal austerity book. And if we study our history, that's shown time and time and time again. The only president to drop an atom bomb was a Democrat. Dropped it on a civilian population, on two cities, you know, throughout, you know, the Old South, the Dixiecrats are some of the most racist, violent, classist motherfuckers that there were. You know, Clinton broke strikes the same way Reagan broke strikes. FDR didn't push for the New Deal because he was an angel sent from heaven to, you know, the Democrat angel sent from heaven to this great leader and help all these people. He did, because the capitalists and the corporate elite and the 1% had robbed and stole so much and crashed the country, the economy of the country, into such a rough position. And the people were so destitute that they were really beginning to look at socialism and anarchism as viable alternatives. And or were rioting in the streets to kind of change one way or another. When I really became clear to me how complicit the Democrats were and what a clear player they were in the war on the poor and on the war against the working class, and I don't mean minor level Democrats really know what's going on. I mean, you know, the high ups in the Democratic elite. You know, I could no longer. That's when I stopped being a reformist. That's when I stopped being a social democrat. I knew what the term was or not. I became like more identifying anti-capitalist. There's a great international socialist organization branch here in Providence, and these motherfuckers were at every protest I went to for like the last 8 years. I worked with many of them in the Rhode Island Mobilization Committee Stop War and End Occupation, which was the biggest anti-war group in Providence from 2001 just up until 2012, part 2002 until 2012, and they played a critical role in the advancing of my politics, and they stopped recruiting me because I told them I didn't want to be recruited, that I'd join if I felt like it. But I got to be friends with a lot of them because they were at every action I went to, and because I worked with them in the RMC. I began to read more about socialism, the history of anarchism, about democratic centralism, about building a revolutionary party. Just headlined the Socialism 2011 conference in Chicago, and Alan from Prayers for Atheists had already. And when I got out to that conference and saw for the first time in my life that I was in a room with 1,500 other self-identifying anti-capitalists, firefighters, teachers, nurses, carpenters, students, professors, it just really, empowered me. And I made a decision that even though I might not agree with, that I knew it wouldn't be perfect, that there would be issues here along the road, that there's issues with any organization that we join, but that, a Marxist or an anti-capitalist without an organization is just floating in the stream. So I joined the ISO that night on stage, and I've been an active member of the Providence branch ever since.
I wasn't going to talk about the ISO, but since you brought it up, it's funny because everybody has different experiences with the ISO. I hear horror stories from people on the West Coast about ISO constantly trying to co-opt every action. If there's a march, they're trying to, take it over and have it be their own thing, which is, it's not respecting different time and space, and it's disrespectful. But the ISO people here in Denver are, I don't have a problem with them at all. All the ISO people I've met here, I work with them on a number of projects, and they're solid folks. In Greece, a lot of the groups, they identify as autonomous. So you have anarchists, communists, just basic anti-state, anti-authoritarian people working together. I don't really know what point I was getting at with that. The biggest critique I hear about the ISO is that they are vanguardists and, would take me and all my friends out into a dark room and shoot us on the day after the revolution. So what do you have to say?
First and foremost, I would say that I don't tell anybody to join the ISO. I don't recruit shit. I think people like our work, and you know that it seems like something for them, then they join. I think that's the way most revolutionary groups function. You know, I think there are a lot of older socialists, you know, who came up in the 80s and the 90s, and that's not that old, but who were radicalized to Marxism in that period, and they felt the stop of debate because they want in so used to being attacked from liberals, from conservatives, from ultra leftists. And to clarify, I mean, we're, you know, I'm a Trotskyist. The ISO is a Trotskyist organization. We don't see Stalin as a socialist. He is a dictator, you know, responsible for murder and, you know, the crushing. He's a counter-revolution. And we don't, you know, Mao is not a socialist. You know, that's dictatorship. To put that out there first and foremost, you know, and if you go to, you know, where we stand, you know, the principles of the group, I mean, I believe in every single one of them. They're on the, you know, the group's on the right side of every issue. And that's what, you know, was another key part in me joining. And also because I wanted to be a part of a radical group that wasn't a nonprofit that had to justify some budget, and that was really going to the, you know, the root of the problem. And, you know, that, like Lenin talks about a vanguard, but he doesn't, you know, our interpretation of that is not a small cadre that dictates what people do. Lenin's definition of the vanguard is just the, you know, the class conscious layer of the working class. And for us, or for me scientifically, you know, it's semantic. Like, if you acknowledge that there is a percentage of the working class in this country and in all countries that is aware there is a class war going on, but is consciously aware shit is not an accident, you know, that there is a class war being waged by the 1%, then you're, you know, then that's what Lenin would have called the vanguard. You know, and that's where the ISO supports all working class causes, you know, all social justice, you know, legitimate social justice working class causes. You know, those are the folks you know, we're looking to organize with the most, or build with the most. You know, that's all that means. You know, and I look at our process. I like having meetings that start on time. And I don't mean to talk shit about Occupy or talk shit about some of my anarchist comrades, but I, you know, because I'm...
Yeah, we start our meetings on time.
That's
I'm just kidding.
But, I mean, that's revolutionary discipline. I like meetings that start on time. I like meetings that end when they're supposed to end, so I can plan my schedule. I like, you know, being in an organization that has nurses in it, and firefighters and teachers and families. I like, you know, there's an accountability in the ISO that I really dig. When people take on a project, they, you know, they do what they say they're going to do. You know, and it's the most democratic process that I know of. You know, there's a... Obviously, I'm not going to turn your podcast into an examination of the ISO, but, you know, we have branches, right? So there's a local branch, and if you're a member of the branch, you're going to be expected to give a presentation. At some point, you're going to have to give a presentation on, you know, a perspective that you want to present, you know, or a piece of reading that the group voted on and agreed to study together. At some point, you're going to be expected to chair a meeting. At some point, you're going to be expected to take minutes for the meeting. Division of labor. Not only because it has to be split up so that, you know, not the same people are doing the work all the time, but also so that everybody, as a functioning revolutionary, can do, you know, is, you know, educated and comfortable running the shit, whether all the veteran members are there or not. And there, you know, there's a branch organizing committee for each branch, which rotates every couple of months. And there's nobody who can't be on the committee, you know, if they make a case and really want to be. At the same time, anybody on the branch committee, anybody on the regional committee, anybody on the national committee can be immediately recalled. You know, and so there's a major conference once a year, and then there's a national organizing committee and a national steering committee that it's all voted on members from the branch. It's all transparent. You know, and in that way, we're able to keep up with one another with what's going on in the country. You know, members of ISO were at Bloombergville, were at Occupy Wall Street day one. Members of the ISO were in the first meeting in, you know, Caucus of Rank and File Educators, Chicago Teachers Union. Jesse Sharkey is a vice president of the Chicago Teachers Union. So ISO member involved in CORE from the beginning. You know, Jesse Hagopian is an ISO member, teacher, union rep, who was one of the key figures in the Garfield High School Scrap the Map victory to kick out the map testing in Seattle. ISO branch from Austin, Texas. They were some of the most radical folks at the Texas State House during the People's Filibuster. You know, a couple weeks back, organized carloads of people to go, and were, you know, played a key role in getting live and getting loud, even though many of the, you know, the nonprofit groups there were, the liberals were, you know, pushed for a complete and total capitulation to the authorities there until it was almost too late, you know. And so I look around and I see shit getting done, people doing what they're going to do, and that's why, you know, that's why I joined, and that's why I continue to be a member. Anarchist groups that I love, I mean, I don't know if you're up on Seattle Solidarity Network. I mean, you know, they're just doing some of the most amazing work. That to me is really lit. You know, with workers who have gotten their wages stolen to fight back against the bosses and picket and protest and wage one person strikes and leverage and actually get workers hundreds, thousands of dollars in stolen wages back, and doing the same thing with tenants and bosses. And if you look at seesaw.net, SEASOL, Seattle Solidarity.net, you know, there's a whole list of victories, campaigns, how they organized them and how they won them listed on the site, you know. Basically, there's never been a better time to be a radical than right now. I think this is the most radical decade since the 60s in our country and around the world. And I think, you know, anarchists, socialists, libertarian socialists, all radicals are you know, if they stick with it, are going to play a key role in the working class, in the raising of working class consciousness. And, you know, folks need to work together and stop one another, so included.
You know? Yeah, I mean, and that's really why I want you to talk about this brand of socialism, because I don't think a lot of people really... A lot of anarchists, I think we just hear so much negative shit about it that, you know, I think it's important to just have more collaboration, because when you combine, like, you know, all these various anarchist ideas, mutual aid, direct action, et cetera, with, you know, a kind of Marxist analysis. I mean, they're also very similar, but there's also significant strengths that where these philosophies interact so well. So I want to see more just general anti-authoritarian, anti-state, anti-capitalist collaboration across the board. You know, I think it's fucking it's crucial. It's crucial. All right. You just got back from the conference, the ISO conference in Chicago. Did you sit in on the China Meville lecture or any of his panels?
Did, yeah. Marxism and Halloween.
What was he, I mean, I listened to the audiobook for Perdido Street Station. You know, he's a Marxist sci-fi author. What was he talking about?
I didn't know that he was an author at the time. I just knew that some of my friends, comrades, said he was a badass speaker. And he was so dynamic. I mean, dudes like that, I just can't even explain it. I mean, we could take 5 minutes just talking about how, like, sexy the dude is. Like, he is, like, you know, just well put together. Like, he looks good. good, and he has a legit mesmerizing way of talking right off the bat. But you know, he was talking about going into how fear, where fear comes from, the role fear plays in capitalism. You know, talking about caricatures of, you know, political caricatures of any leaders who are not actively falling in lockstep with the U.S. government, being projected as monsters. You know, so often when you see a picture of Castro or you see the picture of Chavez, you know, and obviously, you know, most of these enemies of capitalism or enemies of the U.S. government, you know, they're not white. How easily they're literally painted as monsters, and how that fear, you know, someone standing in the way of U.S. corporate and U.S. global dominance, you know, is portrayed as something is transformed and reprojected as something to be feared. He also went into a moment that, you know, changed his life, about being a young boy and walking by a Halloween costume judging contest. And, you know, seeing a boy who made his own Darth Vader costume win, and a kid who had bought the C-3PO costume, which looked good, lost. And he was very young, and he couldn't understand, and he was, like, trying to ask his mother, like, what was up. And he was like, that Darth Vader costume looks so sloppy, but, you know, the C-3PO costume looks perfect. I mean, it looks exactly like the movie, you know? And his mother, like, sat him down, and, you know, his parents were radical, or certainly, you know, had some non-mainstream ideas. You know, his mother sat him down and was like, well, look, you know, the backwards hockey helmet that this kid is bike helmet that this kid is made into a Darth Vader mask doesn't exactly like the movie, because he made it himself. He had to use his own imagination, the materials that were available with him, to develop his own Darth Vader outfit. And that other, he didn't make his at all. His parents bought it from a store. The reason why it looked exactly like C-3PO from the movie is because it's an exact, you know, replica that was made in a, you know, in a factory, and that boy didn't have to use his imagination to make it. All he had to do was have his parents buy it for him. Maybe the boy who won didn't have the money to buy it. Maybe he wanted to use his own creativity and actually build something with his own hands. You know, and he, that moment when that concept locked into place, you know, was a turning point in his young life and led to certain aspects of his radicalization, you know. And he segued that into, you know, the so many different ways, in addition, capitalism wielding fear, how it separates us from so many of our creative impulses and our creative outlets. You know, don't write a play and with your friends and act it out. You know, sit down and watch 6 hours of Netflix. You know,
I'm so glad I asked you that, man. That sounds. I love it when people combine shit like that and break it down like that. It's I think it's really important. I mean, as you're talking about that, I just keep seeing like this Halloween outfit of Gaddafi, you know, sitting in his luxurious chair, just looking like someone just pissed on his face. Anyway. Oh man, I'm fucking. All right, well, so let me ask you this. We're gonna wind this up. do you have any book recommendations to the people out there? Any book or any publications that you like that you think people should read? And don't say fucking Mao's Little Red Book.
Right. well, it's going to be really obvious, but I want to put it out there also. I mean, like, you know, I grew up poor, like dirt poor, as close to destitute as you can, or as poor as you can be without being destitute. You know, and I'm always interested in you know, text that's it accessible and stuff that people are actually gonna read. You know, I'm always interested in things that, you know, kids from my old neighborhood are gonna open to reading. You know, there's so many things, so many texts, so many books. I mean, we can never really read all the things that we want to read. And it's going to sound cliche, but, you know, like a people's history of the United States has come to be like almost this cliche thing where it gets referenced all the time. But I found that so many progressives and radicals have only read chapters of it, excerpts, and have never read the whole thing. That book, you know, changed my life. It is, the facts of the book or the way that it's laid out is irrefutable. It's immaculately cited and sourced. There's like 30 pages of work cited at the end of it. And it's all, or such a large part of it is not just, it's not his editorializing. Actual passages and records of interviews with people, with oppressed folks, with people from movements going back 150 years. If you never read that book, if you're listening to this podcast and you've never really read the book, you've just like heard it referenced on Good Will Hunting and, you know, nod when people bring it up, or you've just read a couple chapters, there is no more thorough breakdown of the actual reality of what this country is than that book.
Yeah, and I'll agree, man. I actually evoked that book in arguments twice today, just to put that out there. Once in an argument, once as a recommendation to a teacher who was asking me some questions. So, 100%.
Respect. You know, if you're looking for something that's more centered, I mean, I would recommend Subterranean Fire by Sharon Smith. And, you know, she's a Haymarket author. you know, and she's a member of the ISO, so I would put that out there. But it's like similar to People's History of the United States, but with a clear on the U.S. labor movement from the 1850s until the Bush era, but just on labor, workers of color, labor, all working class labor in this country, deadly. I read as much or more fiction than I do, movement stuff. I feel like sick, my medication. It's what keeps me sane. It's my mood regulator. It's my, one of the greatest joys of my life. I just read the Foundation series. If you're looking for science fiction, I just read the Foundation series by Isaac Asimov. And if you dig sci-fi, those are some of the stories that, you know, got it popping. And I they're super enjoyable without being too long. I'm definitely a Stephen King fan. Dark Tower, some of the most enjoyable. It's like the Lord of the Rings of my adult life. Pope suggests a book by Patricia Smith, a book called Blood Dazzler. She's one of the preeminent performance poets, one of just the OGs of performance poets. She's been killing it for years, and her work is killing age in addition to her performance. More than just a text, I would say John Lewis, Walking with the Wind. He's a former chairperson for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee during the Civil Rights Movement. Satan gave me that book. Just comprehensive. It's autobiographical. It's just a comprehensive look at, not just the Civil Rights Movement, but the washed over that the radical students in that movement played. It was the students who pushed the movement forward, who took the most aggressive steps and, refused to compromise or refused to back down in so many instances. And hear about civil rights, we always hear about Malcolm, we always hear about, Martin Luther King, and obviously two of the most important thinkers of our time, but, that's what capitalism and what the ruling class does is that, they want us, it's everything's like, leaders, this the great, great heroic leaders who saved the day, and without them, nothing would have happened, and they don't go into the hundreds, thousands of organizers on the ground, who really, spent months out of their lives training for these organized civil disobediences, Greyhound bus protests or freedom rides, lunch counter sit-ins, like the evolution of the lunch counter sit-in where, students in the South were like, well, we don't just want to sit in at the lunch counter in Woolworths and get beat up for our rights anymore. How can we organize 500 people to go sit in every lunch counter at once so they don't even have enough cops to beat us up and arrest us all? By John Lewis. So.
What's it called? Walk With Me?
Walking With the Wind.
Walking With the Wind. All right, well, fucking great interview, man. Do you have any shout-outs? How can people, how can people support you? Where can they find more information on you, et cetera? Shout-outs?
Yeah, I've got a performance, poems, me kicking it live at jaredpaul.org. I cook all the time. Cooking for yourself is a big part about being a radical, in my opinion. Plus, I cook with love, and I love to feed my family and friends good food. My Instagram and my Twitter is Jared Paul PFA. PFA is short for Prayers for Atheists. And that's where I'm, you know, post up pictures of things that I cook and recipes and pictures of protests. You know, those are the easiest ways to get a hold of me. And I just want to really, you know, the last thing that I'll say is that, you know, this is the 2010s, you know, if we're really paying attention and analyzing all the radical energy and the strikes and the protests and the rallies and the pushbacks and the sit-ins in Egypt, Wisconsin, Spain, the UK, Greece, Brazil, all throughout the US, Japan, China, everywhere. I mean, this is the most radical decade since the 60s. It's on pace for that anyway. There's never been a better time to get involved. You don't have to solve the problems of the world in one fell swoop or swing. No one's expecting you to be the, you know, this super person hero. Nobody's a 24/7 activist. But there's never been a better time to get involved. And the only way that shit is going to change is if, you know, people do start joining organizations. I don't give a fuck if you join my organization, just that, you know, you consider finding a group that's working and organizing on an issue that you're passionate about. Because when we're separate and alone, we're just one twig floating in the stream. When we get together, you know, there's a greater power there. A goldfish can't box with a shark on its own. But if you get a lot of goldfish together, they can form great big Voltron fish and chop the shark in half. You know?